and welcome to Paleo Cinema Podcast 119. My name's Terry Frost, and this time around we're looking at a couple of films, one of which I'm a little bit surprised that I haven't done already for the podcast, and the other which were kind of picked up by accident by scrolling through Facebook, and somebody had mentioned that they'd just seen it. They're both, in a sense, political movies, and they're both very interesting. The first one is the 1955 John Sturges movie, Bad Day at Black Rock, with Spencer Tracy, Robert Ryan, Anne Francis, Ernest Borgnine, Lee Marvin, and a host of others in it. And the second one is a 1979 film which had an incredibly fraught origin. It's Winter Kills, starring Jeff Bridges and John Huston. Big conspiracy theory kind of movie. And as things around here at the moment are intensely political in Australia, I thought it was a bit apt that I do that. So I'm going to take a bit of a break now, and when I get back, we're going to get on with the show. Paleo Cinema Podcast is a four-weekly podcast of movie appreciation. I do any movie more than 20 years old, and I will go all the way back to silent films if I absolutely have to. Feedback's one of the important things with a podcast, so you can supply feedback via the email address cultguru, K-U-L-T-G-U-R-U @gmail.com is the primary way of doing this. There is also a voicemail line, which you can leave voicemails on, and it's area code 206-338-9397. Now, that's changed recently, so use that. You can go to the Paleo Cinema Cafe on Facebook as well and join a few little discussions about movies that way. Now, this podcast does contain some adult material at times, so if you're not into that, fast forward through those bits and just enjoy the rest of the podcast anyway. Okay, so Australia just had this federal election and the bad guys won. That's incredibly horrible and sad, and we're going to have to put up with it for at least 3 years. And they're going to do things like the national broadband network that we were going to install. They're going to put copper wire in it instead of fibre optic cables. They're going to screw up the carbon tax we had to try to control pollution and global warming, and in general make everybody treat the whole country like a business rather than an environment in which to live. I'm not going to rant too much about that, except to say if you voted for the Conservative parties here in Australia, please do me a favour, tip petrol over yourself and set yourself alight. Having said that, I'm going to move on to things much more pleasant, including what I have been watching on this, as far as movies are concerned, not on the, well, some of it was on the TV, but in general, cinema. Now, let me have a look. Not really a lot, looking at my Mizu. Let me have a look. I saw Oz the Great and Powerful with James Franco in it. James Franco is a fucking weird actor. I don't care what people say. I don't care if he writes poetry and novels and other stuff like that. He doesn't have a lot of charisma as far as I'm concerned. He's got beady little eyes and a funny looking chin. So I saw that. Yeah, CGI was okay, but it really wasn't anything spectacularly good. Yeah, the plot points reveal themselves way before they should have. Yes, I know it's supposed to be a kids' film, but what the fuck? I did try to watch another movie, and it's not very often that I don't complete a movie. I tried to watch Pillow Talk with Rock Hudson, Doris Day, and Tony Randall in it. Would have been more amusing with Tony Curtis in it. But the sexual politics in that film really pissed me off, so I stopped watching it. I know some people say it's a comedy of sexuality and that Rock Hudson plays a kind of slightly fey character, and because Rock Hudson was gay, that's something. The only good thing about the bits of the film that I saw, which was like the first 30 minutes, was Thelma Ritter, one of my favourite actresses, played Doris Day's drunk housekeeper. And Thelma Ritter stole the movie the same way that you can steal a car from somebody who's bedridden. It was so easy to steal the movie. And the only bits that were anyway enjoyable, Thelma Ritter just walked away with absolutely no effort at all. So good on Thelma Ritter. bad on everybody else. That movie has dated incredibly badly, and I really found myself unable to get into it in any meaningful way. Let me have a look here. I did try. Here's the problem with downloading torrents, and this is the reason why eventually I'm going to have to pick up a copy of this movie legitimately at some stage. I did watch the first, well, I don't know, 5/8 of Cloud Atlas, the Wachowskis movie, which goes from the past to the future and all that kind of thing. And then I was getting into it, and I don't mind it at all. The bits that I've seen were intriguing, and I kind of like it, and I like the audacity of what they're trying to do and all that sort of thing. But the audio suddenly, for the last 3/8 of the movie, went to Russian. Now, I don't speak Russian, and I'm not likely to learn it in any time before I stop breathing. So I couldn't watch the rest of the movie. So just when it's kind of gearing up and it's getting interesting, and the Korean chick from the future is surrounded by helicopters and her boyfriend's shooting at them and all that kind of shit, it changes to Russian. This was problematic for me. So I couldn't finish watching Cloud Atlas. Don't spoil it for me, but I will eventually get to see it. Maybe when the price of the Blu-ray goes down to about 10 or 12 bucks or something like that. So a bit pissed off with that, but I wasn't paying for it, and all I really wasted was lifespan trying to watch it. So, yeah, there wasn't too much else that I've been watching. Okay, a few repeat viewings of things. I wanted to check out, I did pick up the Blu-ray of Iron Man 3, so I checked that out again. I caught bits of Looper, the movie with Joseph Gordon-Levitt and Bruce Willis in it, on cable. You know, you're channel surfing between things and you kind of catch 2/3 of a movie, that kind of thing. So I did a little bit of that, and I have purchased a couple of things. So I'll tell you what I've actually purchased. Picked up a copy of Drive on Blu-ray for 10 bucks. There's a video store nearby which is going out of business, and so I scored that quite well. Picked up District 9. Got Sirens. Now, when it becomes a Paleo Cinema movie, I'm going to talk about Sirens, the movie with Elle Macpherson and Sam Neill about the life of Norman Lindsay. So I'm going to do that because I think it's a very sensual and interesting film. I picked up a copy of Shame, the one with Fassbender in it, but I haven't been in the right mood to watch that, given the fact that the political landscape of my country just underwent catastrophic reorganization, and I'm probably going to continue this kind of passive-aggressive rant as a theme for the rest of the podcast. So I've picked up a copy of that, but I am saving that for a special occasion. And that's about all I want to say about all of that stuff. So I'm going to take another break now, cry into my pillow a little bit about the federal election. And when I get back, we're going to look at Winter Kills. Conspiracy theories galore, really interesting cast. Movie's not entirely perfect, but it's well worth checking out. So I'll be back with that in a few minutes.
Go cleaning windows to earn an honest bob. For a nosy parker, it's an interesting job. Now it's a job that just suits me. A window cleaner you would be if you can see what I can see when I'm cleaning windows. Honeymooning couples too, you should see them bill and coo. You'd be surprised at things they do when I'm cleaning windows. In my profession I'll work hard, but I'll never stop. I'll climb this blinking ladder till I get right to the top. The blushing bride, she looks divine. The bridegroom, he is doing fine. I'd rather have his job than mine when I'm cleaning windows. The chambermaid, sweet names I call. It's a wonder I don't fall. My mind's not on my work at all when I'm cleaning windows. I know a fella such a swell. He has a thirst that's plain to tell. I've seen him drink his bath as well when I'm cleaning windows. Oh, in my profession I'll work hard, but I'll never stop. I'll climb this blinking ladder till I get right to the top. Pajamas lying side by side, ladies' night is
as I have spied, I've often seen what goes inside when I'm cleaning windows. Talky queen, she looks a flapper on the screen. She's more like 80 than 18. When I'm cleaning windows, she pulls her hair all down behind, then pulls down her never mind, and after that pulls down the blind. When I'm cleaning windows, in my profession I'll work hard, but I'll never stop. I'll climb this blinking ladder till I get right to the top. An old maid walks around the floor, she's so fed up, one day I'm sure she'll drag me in and lock the door when I'm cleaning windows. When I'm cleaning windows.
Okay, before I talk about window kills, I'm going to have a rant. I'm in a ranting mood, and I do apologise if this pisses you off. I'll try to make it as entertaining as possible in order that it doesn't. Now, Facebook often delights me. I like keeping in touch with people. I like having a chat with people on chat. I like the links that people present that I can follow and amuse myself when I've got nothing else to do. I do appreciate Facebook as a social medium and as a way of communicating information to large amounts of people very quickly. But occasionally people put things up on there that piss me off, and I'm sure everybody has this experience. This particular time, I'm getting a little bit of this, where people are saying, oh, I really want to see a black actor play James Bond, or I really want to see a woman play James Bond, or I really want to see an incredibly well-trained orangutan play James Bond. I've got a problem with that, a fairly big problem with that. For me, James Bond is culturally specific. It's an Anglo-Saxon hero myth, in a sense. James Bond himself's half Scottish and half Swiss. He's played by a white man, and that's a cultural thing. James Bond is a 20th century hero myth. It's partly about England perceiving itself to be still a world power. It's about the fight of good versus evil. It's about, if you look through the novels, they're about the story of a man going from early in his career to late in his career, and having extraordinary and increasingly unlikely adventures as a part of that. And the movies, to a greater or lesser extent, depending on who's playing James Bond and how the studio and Eon Films perceive James Bond at a particular time, that can vary a little bit. But there are all these people now saying that James Bond should be played by a black guy or by a woman, things like that. It's a little bit like Doctor Who, but I think Doctor Who, there's slightly more of an argument for it because he's not of a specific ethnicity. He's an alien who every now and then glows brightly and turns into another character actor. But I think we can leave James Bond alone. I think it's important that cultures have their own stories. Now, if you want to do a black spy, and there's absolutely nothing wrong with that, I've got no problem with it at all. I really think that that's a great thing. Build your story, build your franchise, create the myth, and create it as a way of telling stories to black men and women, and for a broader audience as well, from that perspective. But don't co-opt it as another culture's story for your own. It is a very much cultural appropriation when you try to do that. Yes, there would be the argument that they will make James Bond a black British man born in England whose parents were something else, but that, of that kind of thing. But I think given also the fact that very strongly Skyfall has looked into the backstory of James Bond, that again, there's a real disconnect in doing that. And also, it's the same thing with female spies. We've already got Peter O'Donnell's Modesty Blaze, which would make a kick-ass series of movies or a TV series, or however you wanted to play it. There are ways of doing that, but pinching James Bond and then deciding that you got to put him in a kind of cultural blackface or a cultural cross-dressing really is a stupid idea. I really want to see strong stories come from a black perspective and from a woman's perspective and things like that. I've got absolutely no issue at all doing that. But I think that doing it by this means is cultural appropriation and piggybacking on hard work done over 50 years by a number of people, and before that for another 10 years by a troubled writer. The other thing I've got with the James Bond films, and I had a little bit of a Barney on Facebook with somebody about this too, where it happened to be a woman, read the James Bond novels, the original ones, Dr. No and Casino Royale, and then complained about how sexist and misogynistic it was. Now, if you can't read a novel from the viewpoint of the time in which it's written, I don't think you should. I think expecting all literature to meet your exacting standards of political correctness and also about gender correctness is pretty dumb. I think we should act ourselves in our daily lives in a way that treats women more fairly than we have in the past. In fact, I've got to do a shout out to Elaine, who's a listener and a science fiction fan friend, who picked me up on a couple of things that I have been doing in past podcasts that maybe weren't respectful of women. In fact, I was calling them chicks. And I can say that to Sal because it's a pet name between us, but when I'm speaking about a wider thing in women, Elaine picked me up on that and said, listen, you're going to send a mixed message and you're not going to, you're going to alienate a certain base of listeners if you keep calling women chicks. And I've told her that I will make every attempt not to in future podcasts out of respect for her, for any other female listeners, and also to kind of train myself away from doing that. I'm not saying everybody should walk down that path, but it's one that I've chosen. And because there are a lot of things, particularly in Australian culture, where women are in some ways not being treated as they should be, our recent female Prime Minister Julia Gillard being a case in point, I've got to be on the right side of this one. Excuse me. I've got to be on the right side of this one. And I think modifying my language subtly and in a way that doesn't at all affect what I want to say is kind of important to me to do. So I don't know how other people feel about that. I'm happy to take on feedback and discussion about it, but that's something I've chosen to do. So that's the end of the rant, and I'm going to actually get into the movies, 16 or 18 minutes into the podcast. But I wanted to put that out there, the James Bond thing, the cultural appropriation that people are asking for there, and the me taking just a little bit more care with my language on the podcast out of respect and out of also an urge to want this podcast to be better than it has been in the past. So there it is. Now let's get on with a movie which is a lot of ways is politically incorrect. Winter Kills, based on a novel by Richard Condon, who also wrote The Manchurian Candidate. The cast is pretty kick-ass. You've got Jeff Bridges, John Huston, Anthony Perkins, Sterling Hayden, Toshiro Mifune, Dorothea Malone, Eli Wallach, Thomas Millian, Richard Boone, Ralph Meeker, Belinda Bauer, Brad Dexter, and a cameo by Elizabeth Taylor, who's in there for no good reason. I'll just do the IMDb précis on this one because it is quite good for a change. 19 years after President Timothy Keegan was assassinated, his brother Nick, played by Jeff Bridges, discovers a dying man claiming to have been the gunman. While trying to avoid his wealthy and domineering father's attempts to control his actions, Nick follows the clues that have been handed to him. As he progresses, it becomes increasingly difficult to discern the real trails from the dead ends and increasingly dangerous as unknown parties try to stop Nick from uncovering the truth. Now, the father in that one is played by John Huston, very much in the same mode that he played in Chinatown. So I'll just do give you, to give you a little idea. This movie is a very dark comedy, and it's kind of episodic. It's very, very episodic, which is not the way it would have been made had it been made now. But I'm just going to play a little bit of the ranting and raving that Pa Keegan, played by John Huston, does spout. Now, you get to picture this. You've got to picture an aged John Huston wearing a pair of red underpants and an open a white robe. This goes on for a couple of minutes, but I didn't really want to cut away from the juicy dialogue.
Come on, boy. Wake up. Got to get our ass in gear.
What time is it?
Time for action. I've been up all night. Talk to Kiewitz and Brunei. Looks like you were telling the truth.
The truth, Pa, and your son.
Well, you always had an excitable imagination. For a while, as a boy, I was afraid you might turn out to be a fag.
You're a real winner, Pa.
Kiewicz is on his way here with that killer's confession. Then we go the limit to bust this thing wide open.
You bring the confession to the president?
Hell no. That moron can't read to find the men's room. We got a picture for him. Evidence. Find the rifle. The men behind this, Fletcher, and the man behind those men. Then we go to the president.
This is bigger than we are, Pa.
What the president will do is resurrect the Pickering Commission. Fucking corpses to begin with.
Well, you accepted that Willie Arnold acted alone.
Sure as hell I did. Was I to point a finger at the Russians, the Cubans, some goddamn hoodlums or industrialists? Maybe throw us in a world war, civil war? Sure I accepted it. I got interests in this country.
Interests in this country?
Yeah, interests. But don't think I fell for the Arnold theory. I've been a hunter all my life. I know the best of them. The best have trouble with one shot of the kind that killed him, let alone three. And then Arnold getting it from Joe Diamond, a punk saloon keeper, while Arnold's handcuffed to a detective surrounded by 75 rookies.
Well, that's what I mean, Pa. We need help in this.
Help? Like who? The CIA? They smuggle my cigars from Havana. That's what they do. Import-export. And the FBI is good for chasing runaways. Fucking the FBI gave the commission its information in the first place, remember? This ain't the 40s anymore. It's a whole new ballgame. We gotta be pioneers, son. We gotta face that we're alone in the wilderness. But we got what the pioneers had. All they had.
The family.
The family unit. God bless you, God damn it, with the best of families. My international vice president, John Sweeney, has files of the high and mighty and low and ornery that make the CIA record look like a corner newsstand. Information's power. And now we're going to use it to get to the bottom of this thing. Then we go to the president and Congress as a family unit and rub their fucking noses in the dirt that killed my son. Now, get your ass out of that bed.
Oh, well, by the way, we won't need the vet.
The vet?
Yeah, the vet for Coco.
Your mother passed out last night and smothered the mutt in her sleep.
Oh, no.
Yeah. Sleeps the goddamn dog. Crazy woman.
I love that bit. It's almost kind of Hunter S. Thompson-esque in the way it comes about. The movie itself is really interesting in spite of that episodic nature. I'm just reading from the Wikipedia page, and there are some extras on. If you get the DVD of this, there are some extras which explain this a lot more detail. But the production was so far under budget that it shut down three times and was declared, and the production company declared bankruptcy. The film had been produced by two wealthy marijuana dealers, Robert Sterling and Leonard Goldberg. Goldberg was murdered by the mafia in the middle of production for failure to pay his debts, and Sterling was later sentenced to 40 years in prison for smuggling marijuana. The director, William Reichert, who did a few other things after this, and much of the cast went to Germany and filmed a comedy called The American Success Company, which made enough money to fund a resumption of Winter Kills 2 years later. This really is a kind of fucked up film from a number of different directions. You've got Sterling Hayden playing another millionaire, we think, whose idea of playing games on the weekend is to get a whole bunch of tanks and armored personnel characters and try to shoot each other up. Keegan does encounter Sterling Hayden in just that one scene. There are a number of actors who just appear in one or two scenes in this film. And they're really hilarious. I mean, Toshiro Mifune, right? You know, Toshiro Mifune from Seven Samurai and any number of other things after that, plays a kind of butler to Pa Keegan, a character called Keith. Now, if there's a name that you're not really going to associate with Toshiro Mifune, it's the name of Keith. And yet, this movie does do that. You've got Anthony Perkins in a three-piece powder blue suit playing John Cerruti, the computer genius who runs Pa Keegan's empire. And he gets a couple of interesting and good scenes in this one as well. They got an interesting Australian actress called Belinda Bauer, who was one of the... she was from quite a well-off family who had a paint company called Taubman Paints in Australia. She plays Nick Keegan's girlfriend, Yvette, and did a few other movies as well, and does have some scenes of nudity in this film. But I think she was quite an interesting actress, very beautiful, but she could hold her own against Jeff Bridges as far as the acting is concerned. So that's kind of interesting. Brad Dexter is in the scene right near the start as Captain Heller. Brad Dexter, of course, was one of the Magnificent Seven, and also was famous for, off the coast of Hawaii, saving Frank Sinatra from drowning in the late 1950s. So he's in there. Richard Boone, we know, Have Gun, Will Travel, The Kremlin Letter, any number of other things as well. Just a really fine actor, and he totally goes balls to the wall in this movie the same way that John Huston does, and really enjoys it. But Jeff Bridges is in there. This is like a 30-ish Jeff Bridges. And he's playing the Candide kind of character. He's the innocent thrown in the middle of a pit of wolves, and who tries to make sense of the insanity of this conspiracy about his brother, the dead president. Of course, there are lots of Kennedy parallels here, not the least of which is one character played by Eli Wallach, whose name is Joe Diamond, who's very much the Jack Ruby character in the President Keegan assassination. So Ruby Diamond, you know the parallels here. But it's a really weird film. Dorothy Malone plays Nick Keegan's mother and plays a kind of drunk older woman. Obviously, she's been married to Pa Keegan for at least 30 years and has suffered for it. And Dorothy Malone was a much better actress than people gave her credit for. She did get an Academy Award, I think, nomination for From Here to Eternity about 20 years before. But even in this film, where she's only got a couple of scenes, she is quite interesting. She's plays it vulnerable. She plays it like she's losing her marbles, which she obviously is, the character. And in spite of that, you feel sorry for her, and really she is a character that draws out the softer emotions in the audience, which is kind of cool. Joe Spinell's in it as well. People might remember Joe Spinell from Maniac. He's in there playing one of the characters, and you do see a lot of familiar faces pop up throughout the movie. It's just a crazy patchwork film, which very much mocks the insanity of the whole conspiracy theory thing with John F. Kennedy, the Jack Ruby thing, all of the commissions that happened afterwards. And, of course, Pa Keegan's very much a parallel with Joseph Kennedy as well. I think of the actors, Jeff Bridges has the worst job because he's playing against a whole army of outrageous and very good overactors in the film. So as he wanders through the conspiracy and finds things out, he really does have to go toe-to-toe with some really shameless fuckers. And that's part of the fun of it too. The movie starts out very seriously with quite an ornate chess set, and the titles come up over people playing chess with this very ornate and elaborate chess set. And I think there may be a kind of misfire in a sense, because it sets you up to think that the film's going to be a much more serious film than it is, whereas it is a black comedy and it is outrageous, and it's a Frankenstein's monster patched together of a whole bunch of different parts a lot of the subplots and a lot of the plotting from Winter Kills, which I've read, and is a lot less slapsticky in places than the movie is. It's lost a lot of the subplots and a lot of the nuance from that. And given the fact that one of the producers was killed during the making of the movie, the other one was arrested and jailed for 40 years, I think he may have come out by now. But, in spite of that, I think it's a worthwhile film because it's not like other films. And again, that's one of the virtues that certain films have. Even a really shit film, like Tommy Wiseau's The Room, doesn't particularly look up or present itself like other films. And you've got to kind of tick a box and give a few points for that in a movie where somebody who may have seen thousands of films decides to make one that's not like other ones. There aren't too many parallels you can make to this one. It's obviously a conspiracy film, so people would put it in the same box as The Parallax View and maybe The President's Analyst and things like that, but it's not like either of those films in any really meaningful way. It's bombastic and outrageous, and without giving too much of a spoiler, Park Higgins' death scene is over the top and silly, but very, very memorable. So I recommend you see that. It is out and about the place. You can find it on a torrent, which I did, because I couldn't find a copy of the DVD. It is out on DVD, though. And the torrent I got did have the documentary, which is called Who Killed Winter Kills. It's a 38-minute documentary about the production of the movie. I recommend you see that as well, because this is one of those films where the stuff around the making of the film is maybe not exactly as interesting as the movie itself, but it does give you a nice little extra layer of flavour around the movie if you know the backstory to it. So I recommend that one. It's ridiculous. That's probably the best word to encapsulate that movie, ridiculous.
Winter Kills. The search for a truth that could shake everything you ever believed in. What Nicholas Keegan will discover is the most dangerous, shattering revelation of our time. The Keegans are an American dynasty.
What am I going to do with these girls, Mr. Secretary? First they're hot, then they're cold.
Hello, Pa.
You all know my son, Nicholas.
Hi, Nick.
They own ships, oil, and swank New York restaurants.
We don't allow ladies in trousers in the dining area.
You what?
Ah, it's no problem. Follow me along the sidewalk.
Because he didn't think I'd tipped him enough. Imagine that.
We will have to ask you to leave.
My name is Nicholas Keegan. My father owns this place.
I'm awfully sorry, sir.
Own presidents.
You think you got those votes on your good looks? I bought them and I paid for them. When I needed cash, I got it. Now, you remember your debts.
Damn it! Why do you think I got to this job? Review the fleet!
Their computers hold information about millions of people,
and his people's,
which can make fortunes or destroy lives.
From our satellite, we can watch everything.
Has to do wars in Africa, troop movements, ship movements, nuclear tests, Sinai, the Panama Canal. Every little thing to check an investment.
Nothing competes today with owning a hospital. No customer credit, pay in advance or get out. Unique product, pay. Laundry alone throws off enough to pay the orderlies in the lab. Hey, Nick. Like a little?
Well, I got a contract for you. One of the biggest contracts ever handed out, anywhere.
Someone is trying to teach me a lesson in futility. Why am I the only one who isn't killed?
They will run you dizzy. They will pile falsehood on top of falsehood until you can't tell a lie from the truth and you won't even want to. That's how the powerful keep their power. Don't you read the papers?
What the hell?
He was caught trying to enter, Mr. Keegan.
That's my son.
They're calling the police.
You begging to die? I'm standing between you and darkest night, son.
From Richard Condon's rousing bestseller, hailed by the New York Times for its shocking surprises and grand entertainment, Winter Kills, the epic spectacle of an American dynasty.
Take my hand!
Stupid! You want to go with me?
Take my hand, Paul!
Okay, on to Bad Day at Black Rock. Bad Day at Black Rock is a 1955 thriller directed by John Sturges and starring Spencer Tracy, Robert Ryan, Anne Francis, Dean Jagger, Walter Brennan, Ernest Borgnine, and Lee Marvin. This is one of the great films of the 1950s, bar none. I really like it. It's dead simple. It only runs 81 minutes, but it's a movie where, from the moment the titles are finished, the plot begins immediately and doesn't let up until the end. Spencer Tracy plays John J. McCready, a man who gets off a train in a desert town called Black Rock, obviously. Now, the train hasn't stopped there for 4 years. It's a great big superliner train, and the whole start of the movie is the title sequence with the train roaring down the tracks. And the film's in beautiful CinemaScope, so it's really widescreen format. And Andre Previn, right at the start of his career, did a fantastic score which just gets you amped up right at the start of the film. And then it kind of goes low-key, so the titles are all ramped up with an over-the-top score with lots of strings and brass in it by Andre Previn. And then a man with one arm that doesn't work, his left arm, has been injured, and we never actually see his left arm. It's always kept in the pocket of his jacket. Black suit, black hat. He's the hero, of course. He gets off the train, and he asks the station master, who has done pretty well because he's kept a job for 4 years when the train hasn't stopped there in 4 years. He asks him for how he can get to a place called Adobe Flats. This immediately scares the station master, and who directs him to the town hotel. He's a stranger in town, and instantly everybody is hostile to him. There are two cowboys there, played by Ernest Borgnine and Lee Marvin, and their names are Coley and Hector. Now, this is before Lee Marvin became the Lee Marvin we know and love from his later films. In fact, of the 10 main actors in this film, 4 of them have at least been nominated for Oscars. Several of them won. Ernest Borgnine won an Oscar, Lee Marvin won an Oscar, Spencer Tracy won an Oscar, and Walter Brennan, I think, was nominated for Best Supporting Actor in the 1940s and may well have won one. So you've got some big gun Hollywood actors in this film. As McCready keeps asking questions about Adobe Flat, Hector in particular starts giving him a lot of shit. And Spencer Tracy's character, McCready, is kind of passive. He kind of deferential. He doesn't give any shit back to Hector or to Coley, or indeed to the character played by Robert Ryan, whose name is Reno Smith, and who basically runs the town. He's deferential. He just keeps doing what he needs to do to try to find his way to Adobe Flat because he's got a mission he needs to do. The film's set right at the end of World War II. The war's just over. And something in 1941 happened, which caused the town to suddenly become hostile to strangers. I'm not going to do a spoiler on it. If most people have seen the film, will know what it is. But this film is beautifully paced. It's just a marvelous thing. The widescreen vistas are perfect. John Sturges blocks the characters and the actors in the frame terrifically. Usually, McCready is on the left-hand side of the frame. So if you see scenes like, there are scenes between him and Reno Smith when Reno's filling his van up with petrol. There's a scene in the lobby of the hotel. The only scene where he's not on the left-hand side of the frame is when he goes up to his room and Hector's laying on his bed. In that case, you see Hector on the left-hand side and McCready on the right. But it's interesting why it's framed that way, because I think I know there's a trope in acting of any kind where action from left to right is successful and action from right to left is unsuccessful. It's probably because of the way we read. We read successfully left to right. So having MacReady on the left through the first three quarters of the film gives you a sense that he's going to do something about this hostility that he's feeling and is directed towards him. But he doesn't. So that builds up the tension even more. And eventually there is a scene in the cafe where he's tried to eat some chili. And things come to a head in a really interesting way. Now I'm going to read a little bit about the production out of the Wikipedia page to give you a bit of background on it. Spencer Tracy at the time was having a lot of problem as an alcoholic. His career just started to dip. He did Broken Arrow, I think, in about 53, but his career was on a decline because of those problems he had with alcohol. Now, according to the Wikipedia page, and of course we always take that with a grain of salt, but this sounds like it's right, Nicholas Schenck, who was MGM's president at the time, didn't want the picture to be made because he felt the story was subversive. And it was. It's about people shutting up against evil. It's about the McCarthy era, in a sense. Everybody's just buckling under because they don't want to rock the boat. They don't want to get in trouble with the authorities, in this case being Reno Smith. And they hide great injustice because of that. And this is just before the House on American Activities thing and the McCarthy thing and all that kind of broke. So this film's right at that point where people's careers were being destroyed. They were being blacklisted. Some of them were going to jail. And this movie came along, which frames itself as a modern kind of film noir western. It's set in a western town. A stranger rides in, literally, on a train in this case. And the bad guys are basically antagonistic towards them. It's a western, but with a modern twist. And yet they made it about McCarthyism. Now, it's based on a short story which was published in the American magazine by a guy called Howard Breslin. It was called Bad Times at Honda. Now, that's they obviously changed the name because they didn't want to say Bad Day at Honda, because it was a little too close to a movie John Wayne had just made, Hondo. So they didn't want to get things kind of muddied up there, so they changed it to Black Rock. And Black Rock works, even though there aren't any Black Rocks there. The landscapes in the film are fantastic. Though it was filmed out at the Alabama Hills around Lone Pine in California, which is the same area at roughly the same time that Bud Bedeker was making those renowned westerns with Randolph Scott that I mentioned a few podcasts ago. You've got big hills with snow on some of them. It's basically a lovely landscape. And it's just perfect. It's one of those movies where the town and the landscape are part of the story. That sense of isolation, a small cluster of buildings in an immense desert plain at the foot of some mountains. It's just lovely, beautifully laid out, and there are a couple of long shots using the coarse CinemaScope, which really enhance that effect of the isolation. The nearest town's 53 miles away, the nearest other town's 53 miles away. The train only comes through once a day. It's a little cul-de-sac of a town where evil happened. And that's the guts of the story, in a sense. Of course, you've got Anne Francis in the film playing Liz. This is around the same time. I don't know whether she filmed this before or after Forbidden Planet, but she holds her own with the actors really well. Even though she is playing a young woman and there's a sense of a relationship with Reno Smith, who is the kind of character that would avail himself of a much younger woman, particularly in an isolated circumstance like this. She has her own story arc in there, and it's there's also a slight implication of the possibility that Reno Smith is paying Liz for sex, because at the start of the film, she hires her Jeep out to MacReady, and he drives away in the Jeep. And Reno comes up to her and says, This is the hardest $10 you ever earned, which has got a little bit of a subtext there. And Robert Wright, of course, being the actor he is, makes it sound really sleazy, which enhances the thing. And the other I mean, there are some great set scenes here. There's the in the cafe where MacReady finally reveals himself and his history. There's that really great scene with Ernest Borgnine, who plays the character not entirely unlike Fatso Judson in From Here to Eternity. He's the same kind of bully, barrel-chested bastard kind of thing. Lee Marvin as Hector is pretty much the same. He had just a couple of years before done The Big Heat with Glenn Ford for Fritz Lang. And his Hector is not particularly bright, but he knows how to needle people. He knows how to get them to start a fight with him. So even the henchmen, in a sense, are well defined in this film. And then you've got the townspeople, which are represented by two characters. Dean Jagger, who plays the drunken town sheriff, Tim Horn, who Spencer Tracy first mistakes for a prisoner because he's sleeping on a bed in one of the jail cells, and MacReady's almost shuts the door on him. He's an alcoholic, and he's been made the town sheriff by Reno Smith because he's pliable and will do what Reno says. And then you've got Doc Vale, Walter Brennan. Now, Walter Brennan, as I said once before in the podcast, I think when I've talked about Walter Brennan in a movie, maybe when I did Rio Bravo, Walter Brennan had two styles of acting. At the start of any movie, he'd say to the director, teeth in or teeth out, because the teeth out actors are things like Stumpy in Rio Bravo, where he's playing a kind of slightly comedic comedy sidekick character with his teeth out, because he had false teeth. And then you've got him playing Doc in this film, where he's an intelligent, articulate man. And in a sense, he's the conscience of the town. He has some great little set pieces of dialogue in this movie, which really do make him a lovable character who, in a sense, is just waiting for someone like MacReady to come along so that they can challenge Reno Smith and repossess their town. Now, I'm going to play the trailer for the film first and then kind of wrap it up, because this is one of the great movies. If you don't have a copy of this one, if you haven't seen it, I kind of envy you, because you're in for a treat. This movie is a great piece of mid-century American cinema.
There aren't many towns like this in America, but one town like it is enough. And because I think something kind of bad happened to him, something they can't quite seem to find a handle to.
Yeah, I don't know what you're talking about.
Well, I know this much. The rule of law has left here and the guerrillas have taken over.
Somebody's always looking for something in this part of the West. This place is our West, and I wish they'd leave us alone.
I swear you're beginning to make me mad.
All strangers do.
Well, I don't. Some do when they come around snooping.
Looking for what?
I don't know. Outsiders coming in looking for something.
Looking for what?
I don't know.
4 years ago, something terrible happened here. We did nothing about it. Nothing. Now something terrible's going to happen again. They're going to kid you with no hard feelings.
What does he say? Who is this guy anyway?
Never heard of him, that's what he says. He checked and there's no John J. MacReady. No listing, no record, no information, nothing.
Nobody like MacReady can raise a pretty big stink. Point is, who'd miss a nobody like MacReady if he just, disappeared?
That'd be better if he went out there and got done with it. What can he find out?
This is liable to be the hardest $10 you ever earned in your life.
I suppose 4 years from now you'll be sitting around here telling people you haven't forgotten me either. That's real progress. In the meantime, I'll be as dead as a... Why don't you tell me what happened?
Okay, I spoke a bit earlier because there was another Oscar winner in the in Bad Day at Black Rock, and that was Dean Jagger, who won Best Supporting Actor for 12 O'Clock High back in the late 1940s. I was mistaken there. But John Sturges, really interesting director. He made some of the best action flicks of the time, much better than anything Michael Bay would ever do, for instance. He directed Gunfight at the OK Corral, which I spoke of on a previous podcast, Ice Station Zebra, The Satan Bug, The Great Escape. He was just a terrific director, and there is some talk that... Oh, and The Magnificent Seven as well, of course. There is some talk that they actually filmed Bad Day at Black Rock both in a more standard aspect ratio and in CinemaScope side by side, but they never used the kind of less widescreen format. But whether that's true or not, I'm not entirely sure. But I really like the film. And I've just noticed something else too. There's a film that Sturges directed that I kind of like, Underwater, which has got Jane Russell and Richard Egan in it, which he made for Howard Hughes in 1955, same year he made this film. Underwater is a bit of a weird film, a fairly low budget one. And one of the screenings for the press that was done for the film was actually done underwater. I'm not sure how the people heard the dialogue and the sound for the movie, but that was one of the big publicity stunts that Howard Hughes did at the time for the film. So just to sum it all up, classic Western. It can be considered film noir if you want to. It can be considered a contemporary drama, but again, a bit like When It Kills, it does have a political side to the film. And if anybody ever remakes it, I wouldn't bother going to see it because it's just a standalone wonderful flick. And everybody in the film does a superb job. One of the other things I was going to mention, and I'm sorry I didn't mention it earlier, was the scene where Reno and his henchmen kind of decide that they're going to kill MacReady. It's really interesting because they're standing in the middle of the town where the road crosses a railroad track. So there's a kind of strong visual symbol there that they've reached a crossroads and they're going into a different place. So I kind of like that too, even though Sturges wasn't particularly a director who went in for symbolism. There is a strong visual symbolism there with the tracks running down the center of the screen to infinity almost. And Reno on one side and some of the other guys on the other side of the tracks. It's just one of those things that subconsciously you realize is happening, even if you don't notice it consciously. And it kind of enhances the dialogue. In fact, Don Siegel wanted to direct this film because he said the script was one of the best scripts that he ever read. And I agree. From the moment MacReady gets off the train, the plot starts rolling there. There's no establishing apart from the fact that he's in a desert town. And at 81 minutes, it's just the perfect length for the story that it tells. And you don't get better than this. See, I've got the DVD version of this. There aren't any extras on the DVD version I've got, but to be honest with you, I don't particularly need them. Yeah, it's nice having all the background stuff around this film, but I think the film itself is so strong and so, not obvious, but you know, that it stands alone very well. And I really like this. This would have to be on one of my lists of top 50 films of all time. Though I don't tend to make those lists because as soon as I finish the list, I remember other films that I've forgotten and can't put into the list of top 50 films. And I get all worried about it and end up throwing the notepad across the room. So I'm going to take another break now. And when I get back, we've got some feedback to happen. But first, here's one of the best jazz songs of all time.
Something I'd like to order something cool. It's so warm here in town, and the heat gets me down. Yes, I'd like something cool. My, it's nice to simply sit and rest a while. Now I know it's a shame I can't think of your name. I remember your smile. I don't ordinarily drink with strangers. I most usually drink alone. But you were so awfully nice to ask me, and I'm so terribly far from home. Like my dress, I must admit that it's very, very old. But it's simple and neat, just right for the heat. Save my furs for the cold. A cigarette, well, I don't smoke them as a rule. But I'll have one, it would be fun, with something cool. I'll bet you couldn't imagine that I one time had a house with so many rooms I couldn't count them all. I'll bet you couldn't imagine I had 15 different beaux who would beg and beg to take me to the ball. And I'll bet you couldn't picture me the time I went to Paris in the man I loved was quite so handsome, quite so charming. Well, it's through, it's just memory I had, one I almost forgot, 'cause the weather's so hot and I'm feeling so bad about a date. Oh, wait, I'm such a fool. Just a guy who stopped to buy me something cool.
That was June Christie with Something Cool. Okay, on to the feedback. The first one's from Tim Leiby.
Hey, Terry. This is Tim Leiby from the Internet in Central New York once again. Glad you liked my last message. I was kind of surprised to hear it twice. But I guess that it was a topic that obviously interests a lot of people. What's the future of video and all of that? Anyway, as you can guess, I'm traveling back in time even further listening to your podcast, and I've downloaded your first 20 off of your website, blogspot at paleocinema.com, or is it paleocinema at blogspot.com? It's paleocinema.blogspot.com. Anyway, I downloaded the first 19 episodes because they weren't on my... they weren't on the RSS feed that iTunes has, and I started listening to them. I listened to your comment about Panic in the Year Zero, or your review of Panic in the Year Zero, and I know it seems like I'm revoicing ancient history getting to your podcast. As I say, I'm working my way through them in reverse order. It sounded to me like, I remember seeing Panic in the Year Zero when I was in college, and it seems to me like you kind of took the opposite message from it as what I thought the message of the movie was. It seemed to me that Ray Milland's character wasn't the hero. He was some, he's like an Archie Bunker type. He's some sort of middle-aged, sort of conservative guy who maybe has vaguely Randian ideas of, I'm a white, middle-class white male, I should naturally rule the world. And when the nuclear holocaust finally hit, he thought, aha, now I can finally prove to the world, just I've been right all along. And actually, he finds out, no, he's dead wrong. He is absolutely worthless without the infrastructure that he's openly contemptuous of. He turns into a bully. He gets pushed around by bigger bullies. If it wasn't for essentially the military showing up to restore order, the big government that he thinks he can do a better job than, he would be, he'd be dead. His son would be dead. His daughter would be essentially a sex slave to a bunch of punks. And his wife would either be dead or their kitchen drudge. I kind of got, as I say, very much the opposite take off of Panic in the Year Zero. I didn't think it was a celebration or even a justification for this guy's character as much as a critical look at this guy, at Ray Milland's character. And boy, wasn't that a great sentence. Anyway, as I say, been listening to, I heard your Godard podcast, Breathless and Band of Outsiders. I'm not as big a Godard fan as you are, but it sounds like you made some excellent points about it. Now I'm thinking maybe I need to go back and rewatch Band of Outsiders, which I, again, haven't seen since college. But glad to see you're still doing the show. Really enjoying listening to them. I see Martian Drive-In's coming up next, but we still have no idea what the episodes are. So hopefully we shall find out soon. Thanks a lot, Terry. You have a great week, and I love to you and Sally. Bye-bye.
Thanks for that, Tim, and I love back to you guys as well. The interesting thing about the Godard episode, I'll kind of go backwards on the comments that you made. Just after I recorded the Godard episode, I was looking through a remaindered bookshop, and I found Richard Brody's book, Everything is Cinema, which is basically the working life of Jean-Luc Godard. And I killed myself. I bought the book. It was only about $10, so I bought the book to go into the vast and expanding film book library I have. And I kind of figured out that this is what happens. Every time I do a podcast about something where I'm going outside of my comfort zone and trying something new, a little while later I'll find a book that would have been really, really useful in doing that podcast. It's just the nature of the universe being perverse, and our little brains making connections between them. But I recommend that one, Everything is Cinema by Richard Brody, if you want to read up a bit more on Godard. It's quite thick, but it's in a trade paperback kind of format, so it's not a hardcover, and it's not particularly hard to find. So I did pick that up. I probably won't want to do another Godard movie for a fair while, but when I do, I'll be ready for it this time around. And, it's worth checking out Band of Outsiders again. It's got a kind of crudeness and a naivete about it, but Anna Karenina is just very attractive and quite a presence. And also Sammy Frey and Priya Brasseur. Just a lot of fun, and I kind of like discovering new things. I hadn't seen Band of Outsiders before. I like discovering new things, and there's just a little bit of a hard exercise to get my head around the Nouvelle Vague, but I did enjoy ultimately doing that. Now, back to Panic in Year Zero, I can see your point there, and I must have done that one about 7 years ago, which says a long time in podcast world. But yeah, I do concede your point that Ray Milland could have been perceived that way. I don't know whether he was at the time, because we can understand the psychology of some characters better than the people making the film can at the time through the virtue of hindsight. But one of the things that did occur to me is I want to do a couple more Ray Milland films at some stage. Maybe a really weird little one called Golden Earrings he did with Marlene Dietrich, which was a bit of fun, and possibly The Uninvited, which is a slightly interesting little ghost movie from the 1940s, back when Milland wasn't the cranky curmudgeon we know him from later works. And then, of course, maybe on Martian Driving Podcast at some stage, I do want to do The Man with X-Ray Eyes, his Roger Corman film, which is interesting as well. But, yeah, I can see your point. And I like the fact that somebody's going back and listening to the early stuff. I haven't got the inclination to be honest. I'll pick him apart if I go back on early podcasts. And I did even do this when I review and edit the podcast I'm recording at the time. I will pick it to pieces and I'll be terribly unhappy with it. But I liked it, the fact that the archive's there. Now, well, that's one thing I was going to mention, so I'll interrupt the feedback session to mention this. I picked up a Chromebook computer for about a couple hundred bucks. It runs a Chrome operating system, a light little low-end laptop, an Acer C7 it is. And I hacked it to run Ubuntu. So I can now run it like a Linux computer. I've got a decent, pretty good Linux computer for a couple hundred bucks. One of the things I've got from doing that and buying a Chromebook is, and if you buy any Chromebook, you get the same thing, they give you 100 gigabytes of ongoing storage on the Chrome drive, which is basically the cloud, the Chrome, Google's version of the cloud. So one of the things I can now tell everybody is I'm going to be backing up all of Paleo Cinema and all of the Martian Driving podcast onto a cloud drive run by Google, which is kind of cool for a couple of reasons. It means that if the house gets burnt down, if Podbean, my hosting company, goes broke, and if all of my computers are basically lost, the intellectual property and the resource that is Paleo Cinema and the Martian Driving podcast, I can keep that in a safe place in a sense. You can only do so much redundancy on these things. I've got a thumb drive with it all on it, a 32 gig thumb drive. I'm going to be putting it on the cloud. I've got it on the hosting site, and I've also got it on a couple of other hard drives around here. So everything's backed up safely now, and I'm kind of glad. And I wasn't expecting to get 100 gigabytes of ongoing, indefinite, no end in sight cloud storage. But I've got them now for buying a really cheapo Chromebook, which I really am enjoying a lot. Okay, I got a really short message from Stephen Puttock, who says, "Hi Terry, just watching Witness for the Prosecution on YouTube. Wanted to see it after hearing you talk about this excellent film." Yeah, thanks Stephen. That's basically what I'm doing here, is steering people in the direction of the good stuff. Glad you're enjoying it, and I hope you are enjoying the podcast as well. Let's have a look here. I've also got something here from Richard Palmer. "Terry, love the show. It reminded me of a small beatnik club scene in Bell, Book and Candle where a French performer does a song and dance while Hermione Gingold interprets the meaning in English. I had seen Band before but didn't remember all that well. The Madison was a high point. You made me curious to see Breathless. I didn't realise there was a Bogart connection. Have you seen In a Lonely Place? I think it's a strong film." Yeah, Richard, I have. But going back to the Bell, Book and Candle, that guy is Philippe Clay, who sounds a lot like and looks not unlike Jacques Brel. But yeah, he was kind of a part of the French nightclub scene, and they got him over to do that little weird beatnik club bit in French about in Bell, Book and Candle, which I like. I really do enjoy Bell, Book and Candle. I'm not sure whether I've done it on the podcast. Oh yeah, I actually have. I'm fairly sure I have. But if I haven't, I'll do it at some stage. But yeah, it's my favourite Kim Novak film. I mean, I know she was in Vertigo, but as far as her as an actress is concerned, her insecurities of an actress actually play into the character nicely in Bell, Book and Candle, even though it is a very light thing, and it was the last romantic role James Stewart did before he got a little too long in the tooth to do them. But yeah, I mean, that one's got great cast. Jack Lemmon, Ernie Kovacs, Hermione Gingold, as you said, and a few other bits and pieces in there. But yeah, it's kind of like a precursor to Bewitched in a way. But the sexual politics of it do let it down at the end from our point of view. And again, is that problem of looking at things through a lens of 21st century perception. But yeah, Band Apart, I definitely like that. I like Breathless as well. Yeah, I've seen In a Lonely Place. Gloria Graham, I find very attractive in a kind of bad girl way. She always portrays one of those women that you can see yourself falling for, but it's not going to be good for you if you do. And her personal life was quite interesting, particularly her marriage to Nicholas Ray, where Nicholas Ray caught her in bed with his son from a previous marriage. But yeah, I like that. And I like Bogart in that as well. Really nice one. For me, it's kind of, it goes well with the, if you're going to do a Bogart double feature from that early 1950s period, In a Lonely Place goes really well with The Barefoot Contessa, which I like a lot, even though it's totally silly and outrageous. And yeah, poor girl becomes a movie star and then falls in love with the prince, but things don't quite go the way they like it to go for very silly reasons. I actually should do The Barefoot Contessa one day in paleo cinema. I haven't done an Ava Gardner movie since One Touch of Venus back in the early days. But yeah, In a Lonely Place, very dark, very good, and very great Nick Ray movie. So thanks for that, Richard. I keep the recommendations coming. Every time I do this, I'll kind of write them down in my book, and I do eventually get around to them, which is kind of a little bit of fun. Now, let me see. I've got something here from Morris from over at Love That Album. Love That Album. He's fixed the problems he had with recording Skype, so he's back on track again with that. So if you go over to type that into iTunes, Love That Album, you'll get Morris's wonderful music podcast. Morris says, just listen to the podcast. On your enthusiasm, I will seek out Breathless. I've sort of been a bit wary of going too much into the whole French New Wave thing. You mentioned accusations of style over substance. I created a bad James / Prometheus storm in a teacup a couple of years back on the Film Spotting Forum by daring to suggest that Jules and Jim was pretentious and dull. To me, it was all style and no substance. That film alone is why I've not watched much in the way of that whole era of film. I'm attempting to correct that with the Melville box set I bought and enjoyed. However, if you say Breathless is worth a shot, then it will be something I'll give a try. Yeah, I do recommend you do Breathless. I'm not sure whether I said it last podcast, but Breathless is a good companion piece to Otto Preminger's Bonjour Tristesse, which also has Gene Seberg in it. Very cool stuff. And as I said, I saw Bonjour Tristesse at ACME, the Australian Centre for the Moving Image, with Sal. And we both enjoyed it thoroughly. I'd seen it previously. But I really have to do Bonjour Tristesse at some stage on the podcast as well. It's a very interesting little film and beautifully shot. So thanks for that. That's about it for the feedback. He said double checking just to make sure I'm not leaving anybody out. Yep. That's about it for the feedback, and that's about it for the podcast. Usual things, please patronise other good podcasts. Gentleman's Guide to Midnight Cinema, the B-Movie Cast, Hammockus Podcast, 1951 Down Place is very good as well. All of the usual suspects. You can go to the Paleo Cinema website, and they're all marked down the side of the front page of the website, and I will have to start putting some more promos for those podcasts into Paleo Cinema and the Martian Drive-In podcast. I've been a little remiss, and I do apologise to those podcasters who have been kind enough to give me promos and that I haven't really pushed hard enough. I'll attempt to amend that next time around. Anyway, I'll be back in 2 weeks with our Martian Drive-In podcast, which will be a lot of fun. And in the meantime, enjoy your movie watching. If you're here in Australia, we'll all commiserate together at some stage and help each other through the next 3 years of Conservative government. We can do it if we stick together and watch good movies. So that's about it this time around. Take care of yourselves, and I'll be back very soon. Bye. And by the way, I'm going to play you out with the theme to my favorite movie of all time, The Bad and the Beautiful, with some classic film score magic by the underrated David Raxon.